From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what went awry as the New York Times tried to choose one Thanksgiving dish to represent each of the 50 states?
Part of the problem is just there's not necessarily, in many cases, a firm idea of a state-by-state food culture.
And why is it we get so passionate when it comes to food?
Food is a common language. You can go throughout this country and speak to anyone, and you bring up food, and everyone can communicate.
And we look at the often testy relationship between Michigan and our neighbor to the south, Ohio.
They blocked Michigan's petition to become a state until we would agree to the border of Toledo.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Working on the holidays. As more and more stores decide to open earlier this year, what's the impact on our communities? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, shopping on Thanksgiving Day in 2014. Then the New York Times recently named German potato salad as a traditional Thanksgiving recipe in Michigan. Many readers beg to differ. We ask why these kinds of lists always seem just a little off. But first, which areas of Michigan are bouncing back from the Great Recession? As my next guest has discovered, the economic report card for Michigan is, as he puts it, a grab bag of the promising and the troubling. Ted Roloff's dug into the numbers for Bridge Magazine. Ted, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Tell us what economic numbers you were looking at for this report card.
Well, these are GDP numbers broken down by region in Michigan. So we looked at 14 different regions in Michigan. Some of them are a single county, others are several counties, and we looked at growth trends, what regions seem to be doing better than others, and also took a bigger look at where does Michigan stand in terms of GDP compared to its peak. And typically the peak for these regions happened to be around 2003, 2004, 2005. So we're also asking the bigger question, just how far has Michigan come back from this, I guess, double recession that we experienced in the past decade?
So let's start with that overall picture of Michigan before we look at the regions, the statewide GDP. How is Michigan doing?
Well, we've had good news, finally, after seemingly endless bad news for about a decade. In the past couple, 3 years, the GDP is climbing back up. That's very encouraging. It still hasn't reached the pre-recession level, which I believe was in 2005. It looks like another couple years, the way the growth trend is going, that Michigan will finally reach that GDP output from about a decade ago.
But you did find in your story for Bridge that Michigan's actually above the five-state Midwest average of the 1.6%. So as you say, it's nice to have some bright news to talk about.
Oh, exactly. And we did look at, in some of the regions, I mean, it's interesting, probably some areas you wouldn't have guessed. The top growth region, as it turns out, is Monroe County. That was 5.5% GDP growth from 2013 over 2012. And we had the Benton Harbor area was about 4.5%, Jackson around 4%, and then Grand Rapids just under 4%. Those were the top four regions in Michigan. Then we had numbers ranging all the way down to, I believe, Midland had a 0% growth rate. And more significantly, you've got to look at what's the big economic engine in the state of Michigan.
Right.
It's still the Detroit region. It grew by 1.3%, which is not what you'd call robust, but it's better than having a minus in front of that number.
Very much so. So we'll take that, although, as you find, there's a lot of room for, say, Detroit and Flint and Battle Creek to see more strength.
Oh, absolutely. And it's curious, maybe not a shock, but I think there was a time not too long ago when people just kind of threw up their hands and said, there's no future in manufacturing in this state. It looked like the possibility that the auto industry was going to go belly up, and people were looking for other answers. But if you look at what's been driving the more recent growth, it's our friend manufacturing. It's come back quite a long ways from where it was a decade ago.
In fact, a good case in that is what we are seeing in Monroe. It's wind turbines.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a small enough region that if you have a single company adding a whole bunch of jobs, it's going to actually show up in the GDP figures. And there is a firm there that's added a lot of jobs, and they manufacture the towers for those wind turbines. They're massive towers, 200 feet tall, and their business is real good.
You also, it was an interesting indicator as you talked to someone who is in Berrien County, where things are doing well. She was actually realizing things were better based on truck traffic.
Yeah. Well, that was, I think she said there's 14 exits off of 94 there, and she can tell things are better simply by observing trucks getting off and getting on the freeway, because their exits lead to all various factories in the area, and they're getting a lot of reports from employers that they're adding jobs, adding shifts, business is up, and those numbers show up in the GDP growth in that region as well. So it's not, if everyone thought there's going to be some sort of miracle other economic sector we haven't seen before that's going to create a new economy in Michigan, it hasn't surfaced yet. In manufacturing, it's not certainly what it was in the 60s, providing the kind of income and security that it did back then, but it's still critical to the state's economic future.
Although I will note, you did find in the Jackson County region, winners were the finance and insurance businesses.
Yeah, and there's other sectors that are going to show growth.
Sure.
It's not consistent across regions. It was interesting in Flint, it was sort of a subsector that showed up. I think it's called telecommunications and something else. I forget what that term is, but that includes a firm called Diplomat Specialty Pharmacy that's kind of a combination call center, and I believe it's a pharmacy supply operation, and they've added several hundred jobs in the past couple, 3 years, and that does show up in that particular growth sector in the Flint area. And I'm sure even though it's not the complete answer for Flint, everyone that has a job in that firm is very glad for its prosperity.
I'm speaking with Ted Roloffs, whose report in Bridge Magazine is entitled See Which Michigan Regions Are Growing the Fastest. It's co-authored with Mike Wilkinson. Let's look at what you heard for the future, Ted. You looked at analyses by public sector consultants. You looked at research done by the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
What do you see for the coming decade?
My crystal ball is imperfect.
But, what do they tell you?
Know, it's funny. I talked with Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard, and he talked about what's going to be leading, what sector is going to lead Michigan in the future. And he said, well, we don't entirely know this. It may be something we haven't even thought about because, I mean, realistically, in an entrepreneurial economy, if one could accurately know a decade or two from where we are, where we're going to be then, we'd probably all be wealthy by investing in precisely the right stock. So it's a difficult guess, but there is an analysis I'm looking at here at the University of Michigan. This one's going out to 2040, so that's an even longer lens. They're predicting growth in private education and healthcare at about 1.2%, professional business services just under 1%, but then a decline in manufacturing. This is jobs.
Mm-hmm.
A decline in manufacturing jobs of just under 0.5%. So, and that's kind of consistent with other analyses that certainly a lot of people think the healthcare sector is going to grow, and there's a logical reason for that. It's the population ages. There's more demand for the system to serve that demographic group. So there are going to have to be more services provided. That means jobs. That means GDP growth. So that's another sector we would expect to be growing.
But I'm wondering, we've certainly seen the trend of younger workers leaving Michigan for greener pastures. What are the worries about having this older population in Michigan, what it could mean for our future growth?
Well, that is a factor in what the long-term projections are, because obviously, if you have an aging population, as people age, they're not contributing so much to the economy anymore. So that what drives economic growth ultimately is going to be the younger people in the workforce. And if Michigan is losing those people, especially the college-educated professional class people, that doesn't portend well. I do think there's evidence that trend is is turning around. We're not seeing the mass exodus of younger professionals that we might have seen in the depth of the recession.
And I know you talk to, when you talk to Professor Ballard, Dr. Ballard from Michigan State, we've had him on the show often with a theme that that he told you, and also Lou Glazer of Michigan Future Incorporated, that the future, we need to do better in education.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, more college-educated people. There's always a comparison made with Minnesota. I'm looking here at the comparison. Minnesota, which has a much higher percentage of college-educated people, they've got a per capita income about $10,000 above Michigan's. So there's often seen to be a link between the education level of the workforce and what kind of per capita income you can expect in a region.
An interesting report card in the story, See Which Michigan Regions Are Growing the Fastest. You can find it at bridgemi.com. Written by my guest, Ted Roloffs, along with his co-author, Mike Wilkinson. Always good talking with you, Ted. Thank you so much.
Yeah, glad to do it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As you plan your Thanksgiving meal, what's the one dish that represents your family? Maybe the one that's been handed down through generations. The New York Times recently ran a piece, a recipe collection, called The United States of Thanksgiving. It had recipes that the Times said evoked each of the 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. Michigan's recipe? German potato salad. Now, that got many readers in Michigan and other states who weren't so sure that the Times got their state recipes right, begging to differ. And that includes Linda Holmes. Holmes is a writer at NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See, and the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Linda, your state of Minnesota got?
Something they called grape salad, which I had never heard of.
Never. So this is a total swing and a miss as far as you're concerned.
Well, to me, it just was something I had never, ever heard of. It was grapes, which you sort of dump a bunch of sour cream in with them, and you mix it up, and then you heat it with brown sugar on top, and then you chill it again.
Ooh.
And that's what it is, and they call it grape salad. And they insist it's delicious.
They insist, because you're not particularly inclined to want to try it. Well, at least we got German potato salad, which people can, they understand that, and it's good.
Well, German potato salad is delicious. I mean, that just sounds wonderful. And as I said, they insist that the grape salad is good. And there are people who say that they eat it, that they have relatives who make it. I don't think it's particularly Minnesotan, but there are certainly people who say, oh, yes, this is something that my, you know, mom or grandma makes and serves like a Jell-O salad or something like that.
Well, it's funny because that grape salad recipe, it had something like 800 comments to date with people saying things like, how ridiculous is this? And are other states equally misrepresented? Where do you think the New York Times might have gone wrong with this attempt at cultural map making?
Well, you know, I think that when the New York Times public editor eventually had to address this issue, she got a comment from Sam Sifton, who runs their food coverage, who I think hit the nail on the head and said, the issue is really that cultural things, he said food, but cultural things in general are not really state by state. They're regional. So any time that you're trying to come up with a definition of a state, you're already talking in many cases about a boundary that's a little bit artificial. People in Minnesota, for example, would have recognized wild rice, but they gave wild rice to Wisconsin. And they would have recognized lefse, which is a sort of a flatbread made out of potatoes, but they assigned that to North Dakota. But those states are all kind of a region, and so they kind of ran out of regional things to assign. So part of the problem is just there's not necessarily, in many cases, a firm idea of a state-by-state food culture or literary culture or whatever.
That's interesting. And then when you think about it, it really does come down to your ethnic heritage, too, because I could have something on my table with an Irish background that other people would go, what? Colcannon? What is potatoes with cabbage?
Absolutely. Minnesota has obviously, you know, a lot of Norwegian, you know, people whose background is Norwegian or, you know, otherwise is from kind of the cold parts of Europe. But, you know, it also has a large Hmong population. It has a large Ethiopian population, a large Somali population. It depends on what part of the state you're talking about. There are a bunch of Finnish people up in kind of the northern part of the state. So trying to find like one thing for the whole state is a little bit, you know, is a little bit of a tough thing to begin with.
Would you take a stab at it, Linda? What would you have picked for Minnesota?
I would have picked something with wild rice. I would have picked some kind of a wild rice casserole, or as in Minnesota they would call it a hot dish. But I would have picked some kind of wild rice hot dish. That I would have recognized.
Well, if nothing else, the New York Times got people talking about this story, for better or for worse.
They certainly did.
Linda Holmes is a writer at NPR's pop culture blog Monkey See and the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Have a very happy, happy Thanksgiving, Linda.
Thank you. You too.
Now, in that New York Times piece, The United States of Thanksgiving, Michigan was represented by German potato salad. That recipe was contributed by Priscilla Massey of Allegan. Priscilla is the author of Walnut Pickles and Watermelon Cake, A Century of Michigan Cooking. Priscilla, some of us did kind of scratch our heads at the idea of German potato salad as representative of Michigan Thanksgiving. How did you come to pick that recipe?
Well, when they called, we discussed a lot of different ones, and so many of them were already taken, like apple pie in New York and things like that. And with such a conglomerate of different people coming into Michigan, I talked to her about how the Germans were a large part of it, and their ancestry, there's 22% of their ancestry is still in Michigan. So it's a pretty big chunk, and the Irish come right after that. And she said, well, let's do something with the German ancestry. And German potato salad came to mind because potatoes have been a pioneer food staple.
And potatoes are such a huge crop in Michigan today.
They are. They really are. And we have some great ones. My favorite one is the Posen potatoes up in Posen, Michigan. And so I didn't do the mashed potatoes and gravy and the green bean casserole or the sweet potato pies and things like this because we all do that. But the German potato salad is a recipe that was found for generations in my family. And my family goes back to Quincy, Michigan, and they were German farmers down there.
Priscilla, what is it that makes that German potato salad recipe so good?
Well, I think, you know, you've got it's a potato salad made with bacon and vinegar and sugar. So you've got a sweet and sour going on, and you've got that mustard and celery seed. It's just got a lot of nice little flavors that blend together. And it's baked for a long time. It smells wonderful. And it just has, in fact, my recipe calls for cider vinegar. And sometimes what I do, if I have a nice jar of pickle juice left over in the fridge with all the garlic and herbs and everything, I use that instead.
Yum.
And it gives it a really nice kick, too. So it's just a nice baked German hot salad. Now, I know other people have emailed me and said that they've made it, and they put sour cream into it. And they are from Norway, and it's almost exactly like that. And I had some Dutch people write me and or email me and say the same thing, that they had the same recipe, only at the end they added sour cream. So there's different nationalities that do different things with it. But it is an old recipe. This is my grandparents, but I found them dating back to the 1850s.
And it's true, you know, all of us, we all have our own special thing that just seems completely normal, where we might go German potato salad, but meantime, we're having something else that really reflects our own heritage.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
If you're Middle Eastern, I have friends that are having couscous and hummus, both on their Thanksgiving table, but they're also having turkey. Or when I was in Sault Ste. Marie for 10 years, I volunteered at the Italian Hall, and I'd have Thanksgiving up there with the Italians, and there'd be big bowls of homemade ravioli and tortellini, but there'd be the turkey, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, apple pie, the whole thing. But just a little bit of a heritage thing going on then.
What's the most exotic thing you've ever seen on a table for Thanksgiving, Priscilla?
Oh, exotic. Geez, probably one of the fun things we like to make is Danish Able Skivers.
I love the name. Able Skivers?
Able Skivers. And I research Michigan food, and well, I research food, period, but I really love to read about the history of Michigan foods. And the Danish pioneers that came to Michigan, like in the Greenville area and Grayling and Gaylord area, they brought their Able Skiver pans with them and their quilts and a few things. But the Able Skiver pan is a little pan with six little cups in it, and you spin a batter similar to a pancake batter, and you spin it around, and it comes out like about the shape of an apple, and Abel Skiver means little apple. But it tastes more like a beignet.
Okay.
You know, it's very light, very fluffy, made with buttermilk. So there's that's kind of a fun one that they make as a dessert.
What is the one dish that everyone in your family insists has to be on your table this Thursday?
Oh, boy. Well, definitely the homemade mashed potatoes and gravy. Definitely my new raspberry chocolate cheesecake, the apple pie, the pumpkin pie, and the green bean casserole. And I use lard in my pie crust. I think they make the best pie crust. In fact, one of my hints for you, though, that I like, do you make pies?
The answer is no, because I love pie so much that it would be too dangerous, Priscilla.
Yeah, okay. Some people make them, and some I understand. Everyone has their specialties. I love making pies. I've been doing it since I was a kid. And one of the things I like to do with an apple pie or a pumpkin pie is after I've made the dough, I've got the flour. I haven't put the flour into the lard yet, but I sprinkle in some cinnamon and nutmeg. So you get a really nice flavor within the whole pie crust, and I never have crust left on a plate.
I can imagine you don't. Crust can be the best. My mother was a farm girl from Ontario, and she learned how to do a mean pie, and then she would take the extra
pie crust
and roll it into cinnamon sugar twists. And
gosh, I grew up with that, too.
There you go.
Yes, and I do it for my girls. Yes. Oh, isn't that wonderful? That's really a tradition.
And here's what we're doing right now is really what the holiday is all about, is thinking of the tradition and who's been there before us and making sure that the next generations can enjoy the same kind of food.
Oh, Cynthia, that's it exactly. You know, food is a common language. You can go throughout this country and speak to anyone, and you bring up food and everyone can communicate. You know, and it's wonderful. And, yeah, the old stories and the new stories of Thanksgiving, and it's just wonderful.
Priscilla Massey is author of Walnut Pickles and Watermelon Cake, A Century of Michigan Cooking, and she joined us from Allegan. So good to talk with you, Priscilla, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. It was wonderful being on your show.
When you think about music from Detroit, you probably think Motown, electronic, maybe some jazz. Lac La Belle is an acoustic duo bringing music of Appalachia and early Americana to the Motor City. Stateside's Emily Fox sat down with the duo to talk about their latest album.
Skip that last train going out. Ain't no way. Drove 1,000 spikes through steel, rail stretching, miles of land.
That's Nick Chalet singing there. He and Jenny Nags are the musical duo behind Lac La Belle, and they're a couple, by the way. They have a new album out called A Friend Too Long. Jenny and Nick, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
So what inspired this album? Would you say that there's an overall theme to A Friend Too Long?
Yeah, I think that what we tried to do was work with characters and try to draw a little bit away from ourselves. That was my goal, at least, and I think that it was successful.
Now, when I hear your music, it takes me outside of Michigan and to a different era. And I know you both studied traditional music in Southern Appalachia, but considering you both grew up in Michigan and now live in Detroit, does Michigan or Detroit ever inspire your music?
It does have its place in our music. This record, because we were working more with characters outside ourselves, I think that we also took on some visual ideas that were connecting to those characters. Although in the past we have used more Detroit-focused ideas with our songs. Like on our previous record, we have some songs that are specifically about Detroit. This record, it's more about these stories and their kind of universal ideas. And sometimes the landscapes that we describe in our music are not just an actual place. It's more of an idea. Like there's a song, Clarion, where I describe the desert. It's not really necessarily about being in the desert. It's about that feeling, that sparse feeling, loneliness, hopelessness.
Dry sand beneath my feet. The desert walks with me. No divine plan for me. Just endless yearning. The night was cold and dim, and I was wrought within. No divine plan for me. Just endless yearning.
I was reading a press release about your album, and it says, quote, "Perhaps one could say Detroit is a contemporary flagship American city, a pressure cooker of sorts. It signifies economic collapse and decay, giving birth to a new artistic renaissance." Now, this is not the first time I've heard something like that, but I'm curious to see what you have to say about that comment.
Yeah, Detroit is a very interesting place, we all know, and it's changed so much in the last couple of years. It's hard to really put into words if you're a resident or if you've been a long-time resident. I think that the idea that there is a new art renaissance in Detroit is maybe not quite accurate. I think that there's just always been a very, very thick vein of art and culture running through the city. And now there's other things happening that are drawing a little bit more attention to what's already been happening there. And I think that some of us are a little bit more sensitive to it than others, but I think that the thing that's important is to always remember going forward that the city has been really consistent in a lot of ways that are positive and creative, and we want to make sure that it stays like that as Detroiters.
Mm-hmm. Through all of the city struggles, I see a strong thread of the artist community holding on through these tough times, and that is what has kept the city together. And I think that's also what has made the city really desirable for some people now, to see the city as someplace they could live. I mean, they're basically seeing what has always been there. It's just in the media a lot more.
Now, Jenny and Nick, you wrote your latest album, A Friend Too Long, in a cabin in the Upper Peninsula. And later, when you were ready to record your album in your home in Detroit, last winter's polar vortex hit.
Yeah, that was
very exciting.
Yeah, that was good and bad. You know, like, we flew a really good friend of mine, old tour buddy, who's an engineer and musician. He lives out in Philadelphia. And so we flew him in to do the engineering. We wanted to do it in the house.
In Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a nice space. We have a good space for it. And we also just wanted that experience of being kind of secluded. And we didn't know, or shut in, I guess. We didn't realize how shut in we would be. Because it really, the morning that Eric flew in was the day that it started. And, you know, we had, even though we live in a beautiful historic neighborhood in the city, we still don't get plowed. And so we were really literally stuck for a few days in the house, and I don't think Jenny left for 2 weeks, to be honest with you.
I left once to get a space heater from a neighbor because our pipe had froze.
But it was good. It was great to actually have that, you know, because we were able to just, there was no option. There was, you know, I think Eric and I left to dig a couple people out once or twice, but we were just in there, and we kept our head down. And we
very
just,
focused.
Yeah, and we were very organized about it, so it was good. And now we have this connection to the record in the house, and I think that it's a little bit more special.
I've been speaking with Jenny Nags and Nick Chalace of Lac La Belle. Their latest album is called A Friend Too Long.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In recent weeks, it has been impossible to go on Facebook without encountering many posts from groups trying to convince retailers to resist the urge to open on Thanksgiving Day. More and more retailers are doing exactly that. Kmart, for instance, opens at 6 a.m. Thanksgiving Day and will remain open for 42 straight hours. Among the groups trying to push back against this growing trend is the group Take Back Thanksgiving. Its founder, Annie Zirkel, is with us now. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Annie.
Thank you for having me.
What caused you to form this group?
Well, the trend, as you know, has been happening for a while. And in recent years, the floodgates just opened. And the slight holding back to midnight went to 10 p.m. and 8 p.m. Now, 6 p.m. is becoming the standard, with like Penny's going to 5, and then, as you mentioned, Kmart being open all day. And it was disconcerting to me personally. I'm a big fan of Thanksgiving and of gratitude and appreciating what you have. And just the thought of shopping on this day just was such an affront to the whole purpose of being with family and connecting and being appreciative rather than pursuing stuff. So I started the Facebook page and eventually the organization.
Annie, it kind of seems that what we're seeing with the stores opening on Thanksgiving Day just grew out of that push to get decorations up in September and Christmas music playing on radio stations before Halloween. And now here we are open on Thanksgiving Day.
It's a progression, sounds so positive. Actually, I think it's a de-evolution of what we used to have more of a sense of boundary. And that's really unfortunate. It's the way the world is now. We have to create our own parameters because the world doesn't do it for us anymore.
Now, the stores, I saw the press release from Macy's saying responding to customer demand. And I will admit, when Macy's first did that, we're opening at, I think, 10 p.m. or 11 p.m., or whatever it was, midnight, we were curious, and we went to see what it was like. There were a lot of people there.
Yeah.
So how do you respond to the retailers saying, look, we're doing what we can to stay alive?
Yes. And I'm not actually anti-business. Some people sort of claim that for me. I'm anti-national, multinational corporations who are very disconnected from their workers and the communities that they're in, and who aren't they themselves holding the line and saying, no, Thanksgiving is important. So I do want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. But I do understand the way competition works. It's always about how do we get in, how do we sneak in just ahead of our competition and steal a little bit more of market share. And so this is why I don't think leaving it up to retailers is a good idea, because there's not a lot of thoughtfulness going on. Although that said, there actually are some companies who I say, you know, there's still some hearts beating in some boardrooms out there. And you've got, you know, Costco and TJ Maxx and Barnes & Noble and Bed Bath & Beyond and others. And then you have, you know, Michigan companies, local companies who would not think to open on Thanksgiving because they're very connected to their workers and they appreciate them and they don't cross that line. But it is this certain segment that we're really just kowtowing to. We're just saying, no, no, this is important. When, in fact, actually data shows they do less for our communities. These national, multinational corporations that come in, they don't pay well. They take a lot of the profit actually out of the communities versus these locals. And so we do have it backwards. It's not about the economy. It's about what kind of economy do we want and how do we help the economy coexist with other values that we as a nation want to also express, that it isn't always about the dollar.
But what do you just say to the people that say, let it be between those who want to go out and shop and those who choose to stay home with the family and eat turkey and watch football?
Yeah. Well, so there's more than two sides. And the third side is the worker who isn't getting a vote here and is losing their Thanksgiving. And not all workers are upset about that, but the majority I have found, and I've talked to quite a lot of them, really are very disappointed. And it breaks my heart, some of the stories of people who are losing their Thanksgivings.
Such as?
Well, even up at Briarwood, you know, and here was something that I actually was almost appreciative of. So these two 20-year-old young women I was talking to, and they're heartbroken that they're going to have to work. And I thought, wow, well, at least that speaks to the next generation as not all just being like, well, whatever. However, most of the shoppers at Briarwood will be in the teen to 20-year-old age. So we're kind of getting that. But they're very upset. They want to be with family. And they're not getting to do that. And that actually, you know, in some ways it makes me feel better. But, you know, this woman, if you go to the website, there's some stories that people have shared and we've sort of reposted. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this young woman whose dad is terminally ill and she's not going to be able to be at that Thanksgiving because she'll get fired. So, you know, I get it that sometimes you can work with retailers and sort of explain your position. But we really need to be at a place where it isn't an either or like that. We need to have some way to carve out something other than shopping as being the most important thing. 363 days, we can carve out a couple. And it's good for us. You know, it's actually good for us. And not everybody kind of gets that. But, Yeah, so I've heard from lots of different mindsets, you know, other people work and, you know, they just don't get it. I find that most people who don't get it, they can't find the heart in it. Their heart's shut down. They're not open to seeing people and caring about that.
Have you had any success stories in a sense of talking with some business owner in a power to decide whether to stay open or not that you were able to convince them not to open?
That I personally have? No, but that would be nice. I have heard some good stories. Even in Briarwood, there is – I won't name the company, but the manager there talked the owner into not opening, and he was just ecstatic. You know, he needed the job, but he wanted to be home with family, and he was thrilled. And that's sort of the thing. At that level where you can actually talk to the owner, where they see you and they understand – that's what we're not getting with the big box stores. So,
what do you hope that the efforts of Take Back Thanksgiving might do, if not for Thanksgiving Day 2014, going forward?
Well, yes, because it's not a one-shot deal. I do hope it's an awareness-raising campaign, that we're just a little bit more thoughtful about our efforts, about our choices. What are we doing? There's a lot of wisdom that's getting lost here because we're moving to this place. I just think that the people who are making these shifts are not – they're not wise. Retailers can't – they're not thinking like, yeah, but, you know, Thanksgiving. They're just thinking market share. They won't even call it Thanksgiving if you notice the advertisements. They don't say we're open on Thanksgiving for our Black Friday sales. Black Friday sales start 6 p.m. on Thursday. Mm-hmm. They're not even acknowledging that it's a holiday. So allowing them to have the voice and people who either don't care about Thanksgiving or really just they don't see the cost. I think we need a third voice, and I think that wisdom needs to really be raised louder. And gratefully, I'm seeing it a lot where I'm speaking. I have to say, ultimately, though, I do think I would like to see a legislative option to carve out a Thanksgiving preservation bill. I haven't found any legislators to get on board with that yet, but I'm still looking. So if you're out there, feel free to contact us.
Annie Zirkle is the founder of Take Back Thanksgiving. The website is takebackthanksgiving.org. And we want to thank you for sharing your views and your work, and do keep us posted.
Thank you, and thank you for caring.
Is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This weekend's Michigan-Ohio State game not only focuses attention on one of the longest, deepest rivalries in college sports, it reminds us anew that Michigan and Ohio have been at loggerheads for the better part of 200 years. Exhibit A, the Toledo War of 1835. But there's so much more. Let's find out how and why these two neighbors have had such a testy history. Alan Naldret is with us. He's author of Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. Alan, this rivalry, it goes back to even before Michigan became a state, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, way back. In fact, the original Toledo War was over this tiny strip of land that was Toledo that wasn't even considered valuable until canals started to come around. And then suddenly Ohio decided we better include this in the Constitution that we're writing so that the land is ours. Although way before their Constitution, in the 1787 Northwest Ordinance, the boundary had already been set up, and it was very widely known that it was Michigan territory. And in fact, Michigan was governing the area and was part of Monroe County.
As you say, no one cared a whole lot until geographically that port of Toledo became very important.
This guy actually wrote a book about how Toledo was going to be the greatest city in the world because of its location, because of canals. And the Erie Canal was just starting, And everything was going great because of now they could go faster from one area to another. It was great transportation. And ironically, by the time the whole Toledo War blew over, nobody really cared about canals. It was the big time of the railroad came in. So,
well, it kind of seems that Ohio was trying to game the system when it applied for union to the Union for Statehood.
Not only that, they took Michigan and would not let us literally become a state. They blocked Michigan's petition to become a state until we would agree to the border of Toledo, until we would give them the area that was the Toledo Strip, which already had four post offices in it that were Michigan post offices.
I loved how you described in your book, Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. They kept drawing new maps, and they kept sending more people in to try to do that. And, of course, it was much more difficult back then in the early 1800s.
Exactly. And their solution was just, well, let's go survey it again. And depending on who gave them the directions, the line would come out however they decided it would be.
Now, you tell us one of the biggest reasons behind this Toledo War of 1835 is a man named Major Benjamin Stickney. Quite an eccentric gentleman, as witness the names he gave his two sons.
Oh, one and two Stickney, yes. You would think that they would change their names, but no, I have a picture of two Stickney's tombstone, and he kept two. But also, his daughters were named after states. His daughter Mary was really Maryland. He had a daughter named Indiana, who appeared in accounts quite a bit afterwards, and a daughter named Florida.
Tell us who he was and why he was important to that area, and how did he help drive the war?
Major Benjamin Stickney, it was an honorary major, but it didn't stop him from using it for the rest of his life, took the initiative to really settle Toledo. He was the person who wanted to have Port Lawrence originally. When that failed, he started Vistula. Those two settlements basically got together and formed Toledo. And Stickney was the guy that was first for Michigan, and then when it was to his advantage and everyone else's, he figured, well, Michigan's never going to be a state. We better be with the state. Now, then he got everybody to go for Ohio that he knew, and they kept doing surveys, like you said. Where should we be? Should we be in Michigan or should we be in Ohio?
Now, tell us about the war, and you paint a pretty comical picture of the Toledo War of 1835.
Well, one of my impetuses for actually writing it was the seriousness with which it was usually treated in history books earlier. And I couldn't understand how you could seriously treat both states. Michigan was a territory at the time, put together militias to fight each other, and then both militias got lost in the Great Black Swamp and never even engaged in a battle. In fact, they were lost for like a week. The closest they got was yelling taunts at each other across the Maumee River. Now, that is the way to have a war, I think, but that's basically what it was.
No blood was shed. And where was the Great Black Swamp?
Great Black Swamp is pretty much has been drained now. But Michigan was originally considered the land of ague and ills and malaria. Got a really bad reputation. In fact, one of the first people that surveyed it and gave the land to Ohio was Edward Tiflin, who said that Michigan wasn't worth anything, just a big swampland. Actually, the Great Black Swamp was part of that swamp area, pretty much, right around Toledo in that area.
Hmm. Now, how did
Lucas County.
Lucas County. How did the fight over Toledo ultimately get resolved? Who got what?
Well, Michigan was in limbo, actually, really, for 1836, the whole year of that. Jackson put his foot down and
Jackson mean President Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory.
Yes. Jackson insisted that we settle it, and the way that he would do it would be to give Michigan the Upper Peninsula, that vast wasteland, as we thought. Actually, it was two-thirds of the Upper Peninsula. We were already going to get Sault Ste. Marie. That was undisputed. That was Michigan part. But we'd have to give up the Toledo Strip. When they first took a vote on it, the Convention of Dissent, they voted that, no, we're not going to do that. And so after that, there was no provision set up for anything else. And it was really pretty much an illegal convention held here in Ann Arbor, the Frostbitten Convention, it was called, because it was held in the dead of winter in January 1837. And it was also held in the building that was having malfunctioning heat.
So they were freezing.
Yes. So they very quickly decided, because they'd been in limbo all of 1836, they didn't know if they were a territory or state then. They sent people to the Congress, and Michigan was accused of trying to break into the Congress, and they wouldn't let anybody actually vote or do anything. And then from there, they finally did agree, okay, we'll take the Upper Peninsula, which, you know, turned out great for Michigan.
And we'll let Ohio have Toledo.
Yes.
And these days, here we are carrying on this tradition with the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry and also the Tigers and the Cleveland Indians. So we're working that testiness out today in sports.
In fact, the Ohio people always thought the Wolverine was a dirty, smelly animal. So they called the Michiganders Wolverines in the Toledo War. It was pretty much where the phrase started. Michiganders embraced it, though. They would say, hey, on behalf of the Wolverines, we arrest you, when they would arrest people. And they would embrace it because the Wolverine was this tenacious little animal that could take these big animals on, and it did. So Michigan became the Wolverines. And when it came time to have a football game between U of M and Ohio State, you can believe that Michigan had more than football on their mind as they were fighting against the Ohio Staters. So Michigan really, for many, many years, had the advantage in that battle.
Alan Naldrett, whose book is Forgotten Tales of Michigan's Lower Peninsula, Turn Over the Stranger Side of the Mitten's Past. Very fun to talk with you, Alan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Plank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.